on the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 107 of Strictly Confidential. It's a nice prime number this evening. I am Peter Godbold. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday. January the 23rd, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Wednesday evening in the Eastern Time Zone, which is January the 23rd of 2008, you are indeed listening to a live show. And you're welcome to call in and participate in Conversation Radio with myself and with the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The telephone numbers for the show, toll-free, 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-4, head-on. Or if you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. As I say, we are listener-supported. And that number is 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and it rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the email during the breaks. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. And there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the previous shows. You'll find links to the various guests' websites. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active this evening. And you'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site. There you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on this network. And you can also participate in helping to support the network with the PayPal button there. You'll keep the packets passing and the cassettes cassetting and the CDs spinning and the hard drives whirring along, and that is very much appreciated. You'll also find links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. What an interesting week it's been so far on this program. We've had so many wonderful people on the show, so many great guests, wonderful music, and it's just been a thrilling week. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself with you, and thank you for spending so much time with us and for supporting this show. We have a wonderful guest this evening. In fact, we've had several guests from the Victory Fund, the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund. Denise Williams is one of them. Denise Williams. Or is it? No, that is Simmons. I'm so sorry. Yep, I am reading off two separate pieces of paper. We are welcoming Denise Simmons to the show. I'm so sorry, Denise. Denise has the distinction of being the first American, African-American lesbian to serve as a mayor of a major city. She is a lifelong resident of Cambridge, and she's raising grandchildren who are currently in the Cambridge Public Schools. 10 years in the Cambridge Public School Committee she's been. She served as the executive director of the Civic Unity Committee of the City of Cambridge. She's serving her third term on the Cambridge City Council when she's now appointed to be the mayor, chairing the Neighborhood and Long-Term Planning Committee. She's a member of the National Committee on Youth, Families, and Education and Human Development Committee / National League of Cities. With the Massachusetts Democratic State Committee, the Massachusetts Municipal Association, the NAACP, and she has a list of service awards and education awards and distinguished service awards longer than my arm. Denise Simmons, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Thank you, and good evening. It's great to be with you.
It is wonderful to have you here. I'm so sorry about stumbling on the name. I often have stacks of paper and things like that happen when you get to be 54. I hope you understand.
Oh, that's all right. Not a problem at all. And I'm sure Denise Williams is a wonderful person wherever she is.
I'm sure she is, too. I am thrilled to have you on the show this evening, Denise. What an accomplishment. And I have to tell you, growing up in the South, and in the rural South, to amplify that, It just thrills me to no end to see that this is happening, and the wonderful things that are happening in Massachusetts. You've had a long journey to this point. Tell us about yourself and about the city, please.
Well, you know, Cambridge is a great place to live. You know, Cambridge is a city of a population of about 110,000 people. It's 6.2 square miles, and that includes the water. So it's a very dense city, but it's a city that's very rich in its diversity. You know, it's the home of Harvard University and MIT and a number of great institutions. But I guess what makes Cambridge the place, the wonderful place that it is its people. Where can one like myself, who grew up in Cambridge of modest means, went to school here, went to the local University of Massachusetts, and later on to get a graduate degree, but who would expect that I would someday become the mayor of this city? This is what happens in Cambridge, where I can live out, be openly gay, and be able to live a rich life with my children and my grandchildren. So it's an exciting time, and it's a great place to certainly live.
Well, this is wonderful, and you're bringing a huge smile to my face. Just the fact that you have done this means so much to so many of us. And to Cambridge's credit and to Massachusetts' credit, you are actually taking the place of a black gay man, an African-American
right,
gay man. This is just amazing to me. What's it like to live there? It's got to be very different than living here.
Well, you know, not that I've lived other places. I've always lived in Cambridge. But from what I know from having traveled fairly extensively, that Cambridge is, in a good way, unusual. So it's a good and unusual. You're correct in saying, you know, we elected the first African-American openly gay mayor back in, I want to say, 1992, where he served with distinction for two terms, and then would later be selected to serve again in the 2006-07 term, and then to be able to follow on his heels was really quite extraordinary but wonderful. But we're also the city that in May 17, 2004 played host to the hugest same-gender marriage equality event in the state. We had 4,000 people on our lawn, the city hall, 600 inside the city hall, registering same-gender couples to be married, and then 2 days later, after, you know, there was that three-day waiting period, able to marry couples. And we did that right in Cambridge, the first city in Massachusetts to register same-gender couples. Incredible. In my own service on the school committee, I was able to appoint the first openly gay family liaison for the GLBT community. And the role of this person was to help GLBT families navigate our school district, which is gay-friendly in general. But every once in a while, you just want to know, where do I go? Where can I send my kids to a school where they themselves and their families will be affirmed and uplifted? And to have that happen was extraordinary. It just really attests to the fact that Cambridge is a progressive place to live and a really wonderful place to raise your family and raise your family in a gay or same-gender household.
Denise, in your long list of credits, I see that you are Justice of the Peace. Have you, in fact, done some of the marriages?
Well, I have to tell you, in my very first, right after May 17th, that third day, I was between May 17th and, I would say, the end of the year, married over 100 same-gender couples. It was wonderful. But the most exciting were those weddings that I did from couples who had previously, 2, 3, 5 years earlier, had commitment ceremonies to come back and marry those, to really marry, to be able to say, by the power vested in me by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I now pronounce you legally married, was just a tremendous feeling. And I see a number of those couples still today. They've got children. They're just doing wonderfully together. It cannot even imagine just how affirming and uplifting it was to be able to do that.
Well, Denise, being an old softy myself, I have to tell you that practically brings tears to my eyes. Such a wonderful thing to happen. We do news stories on this show continually about the various states and about the anti-gay movements and the anti-LGBT movements and the attitudes. I understand that that hasn't actually gone away in Massachusetts. You have some nasties up there still raising hell. Is that right?
Well, I don't see very much of that. I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, you hear a little grumbling here, but the affirmations are just so loud and so prevalent. They sort of drowned any naysayers out. And most of your negative comments, we really heard those during the debate around marriage equality. You know, we had May 17th. The sky didn't fall. People kind of just went away. And there's no place to sort of have an audience to have negative things said. So I really don't hear anything that's negative, at least not here lately.
I proudly say from time to time that Massachusetts is a state with the lowest divorce rate and the lowest number of teen pregnancies, the lowest number of abortions, and the lowest number of dropouts, and that gay marriage hasn't hurt a thing. You should be very proud of the state.
I am. It's wonderful to live here. I think of my daughter. I have a lesbian daughter who went to her prom with her same gender gay and had a great, you know, where else would that happen? My youngest granddaughter who professes very proudly that she has two mommies, and, you know, where can you do that and not have any sort of reprisal against you? So not very many places. So I'm not going to be leaving Cambridge anytime soon.
Well, now we have one of our listeners is Alan. He's actually a long-haul trucker, and he travels from state to state. We never know where Alan is going to be. The other evening he called. He happened to be in Massachusetts. They were unloading his semi, and we asked him to bring back a big chunk of Massachusetts for us. We so desperately need it down here. Denise, tell us about it. Apparently becoming mayor is very different there. In this county, in Florida, it's a regular election. They put it on the ticket with, you know, various other sundry items to vote on. Apparently, it doesn't work that way there. How does the becoming a mayor work in your city?
Well, let me take a step back. You know, first of all, the way our elections run is a bit odd. We have what's called PR elections, which is proportional representation. And in that election, you can vote for everyone that's running. So if 18 people ran, you can vote for all 18, but you have to rank order them, 1 through 18. And then through a process of what we call making quota, which is the number of votes cast divided by 9, adding back 1, is the number of votes that you need to get elected. That's the very oversimplified way of saying it. But once those 9 counselors have been elected, from that day, election day, last year was Tuesday, November 7th, right until the mayor is actually chosen, there's a lot of negotiation and jockeying back and forth to see who's going to accumulate the required number of votes, which is you need 5 votes. It's not just a majority, but it has to be 5 votes in order to get elected. So you spend a good deal of your time, you know, negotiating and talking with your colleagues to get them to vote for you. Now, one of the things that one of my selling points to my colleagues was that I had the credentials. I have served on the school committee. I've gone to the public schools myself. My children had gone to the public schools. My grandchildren currently in the public schools. I was a member of the school committee, and I'd done a lot of work around the schools, and I felt that given those who I served with, all who were very well suited for public office, none were as qualified when it came to the school committee, which is one of the duties of the mayor. The mayor not only chairs the city council, it chairs the school committee. So I think that message resonated with with the membership of the council, you know, and I just kept coming at them with the same statement that I'm qualified for this job. I'm qualified for this job. I would enjoy your support. I will work hard with you. And over time, it worked. And I won the favor and became the mayor.
I think that's wonderful. And now that you're bringing up education and talking with some of the other folks that have come to us through the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, for instance, Fred Mason, Baltimore City Council District, Jeff Anderson was running for Duluth City Council at Large, mm-hmm. Howard Bayless, mm-hmm. Various folks from just about every state. One of the things that they bring up to us is the disrepair on the state of in the area of education. Apparently, this isn't the case because I always think of Cambridge as a high tech. Many businesses there that are in the electronics business and higher tech. How is the unemployment rate, and how is the city doing along those lines?
Well, you know, our city manager, we have a Plan E form of government, so it's a weak mayor, strong city manager, and our city manager was just saying that we have a triple. A triple bond rating. We have very, very strong fiscally, and even though we're somewhat in a fiscal downturn, our city is still very, very, very strong, which is one of our benefits. We're also sort of the center of biotechnology, nanotechnology, and the life sciences, and so we are really enjoying a tremendous growth in business opportunities. Our revenue stream is very strong, and we're doing really well, and that contributes to the presence of the university community, the presence of the biotechnology community that is resides here. So we really are doing very well. We have our per pupil expenditure is $23,000 per child. So we are rich in resources, and we have laid off any teacher in a decade. So we're very strong.
Denise, one of the things that impresses me so much about you, and it's one of the things we often talk about, not only on this show but on the network as a whole, fair wages for a day's work. I noticed that you have been endorsed by a long list of unions, the Carpenters Union, the AFL-CIO, the IBEW, and that would only be three of a much longer list. This is very important to us. Tell us about your relationship with labor and how you came to get these endorsements, because I think it's a wonderful thing.
Well, first of all, always believing that, you know, each person that goes out to work should be treated fairly, paid fairly, and have decent working conditions. And one of the things that we want to make sure is that any building that goes up, any nail that's hammered, any work that's done, particularly on a larger scale, is done with union labor, because we know that the unions are what keep our country, but in this case Massachusetts and our city, Cambridge, very strong. So I've prided myself with working with the union community to continue their strength, to make sure that they have fair representation, and make sure that any time that there's a building or a large project that's going to happen in Cambridge, that it is done with union help.
Well, as you probably know, Denise, the huge part of the country doesn't have that sort of support at all. In fact, there's so many union-busting governments at local levels all over. We often talk about what's going on in West Virginia with the coal miners, and it's throughout the South anyway, but this is all very encouraging. How does the mayor's, in other words, does the mayor's office participate in bidding and hiring companies do this? How would the mayor's office interface in supporting that?
The mayor does not get into direct negotiations with union because, as I said earlier, because we had a Plan E charter, which is the city manager form of government, the city manager does most of the direct negotiations on any large contract. But what the mayor's office can do through the city council is set the tone for what it is that we will have. The city council, through the mayor's office and the mayor on his or her own, in my case on my own, has said very clearly that we will not allow any large construction project to be done without union help. And that's a message that we've been very firm about and very committed to. And because we have that strong policy, that strong sense of support for the labor unions, we just don't go forward. We make sure that not only that there is union representation on all jobs, and we keep an open door. That's one of the things that I plan to do very soon in my term is to have what I would call a union breakfast, bringing the unions together, saying, please let us know how we can continue to work together. And the one thing that our unions are very good about is encouraging and engaging our young people. Through our high school, we have it's called the Ridge School of Technical Arts, and we continue to work to strengthen that program where they take some of our students and put them into the apprentice programs. We really want to strengthen, encourage, and keep strong our union relationships.
That's an amazing story. I'm wondering about your neighborhood businesses. So many neighborhoods in the South, and even small towns in the South, are completely devastated by Walmarts moving in. Common problem down here. How are, for instance, the mom and mom businesses, the dad and dad, the mom and dad businesses, are your neighborhoods fairly intact?
Our neighborhoods are fairly intact, but I mean, we do begin to see the erosion of the small neighborhood business. We have a lot of them, not as many as we did a decade or two before. In fact, for a very long time, we had a moratorium on franchises. You just could not bring them into the city, and for a while, that sort of kept them at bay. They're beginning to come back, but we really try to keep a delicate balance. We have neighborhood studies that we do every so many years, which go out into the neighborhoods and say, what would you like to see here? We have a very strong economic development department that really tries to encourage, to the degree that we can, small business opportunities. It's not as long, not as strong as we would like, but we're working toward maintaining and sustaining the small and micro businesses. One of the things that I do is I own a small insurance agency, and through our economic development department, my staff and I have been able to take advantage of programs and workshops that support and help you sustain your business by, you know, writing strong business plans and facade improvements and things of that nature that keep our small and micro businesses afloat. And so it's really, we do all that we can. We cannot bring businesses into our city. We can encourage a business once it's started up to stay and try to give as many supports so that it can continue on.
Denise, what would you say that your top priority would be coming in as the new mayor?
So my top priorities are certainly education. Again, having children in the schools, I think of education as first and foremost. I mean, I often say that education is the passport to the future. If we do not educate our children well, then we will certainly suffer from having not done that in the future. But along with that, housing, economic development, one of the initiatives that I've been working on last term and we're going to bring forward this term is our green jobs proposal. You know, green jobs are the new blue collar jobs. And what we're trying to do is work with your unions, our local businesses, our universities to develop a green collar policy to develop a green collar workforce so that we can employ all of our citizens from entry level to very high skilled and trained positions. We have young people coming out of school that may not all want to go to college. We want them to be able to be engaged in this green-collar workforce, be gainfully employed, and then continue. We want to encourage entrepreneurial opportunities in the green-collar environment. There's just so much to be done. There's a man out of Oakland, California named Van Jones who talks about this a lot, and he's come here to Massachusetts on several occasions to help us develop this green-collar workforce and this green-collar policy. So I'm very excited about this opportunity to launch a program that I think is going to propel us well into the future, but also help us sustain our environment.
Denise, something that just dropped my jaw as when I read this today was the city's response to, apparently in 2006 there were some shootings in a place that you call Area 4 and Riverdale, and that you called an emergency meeting of the city council to take up the issue of neighborhood violence that, of course, all cities have. But what I'm getting at is this implies to me a very deep level of actually caring about the residents. What would you say the relationship between the citizens and the city government is there?
I would say it's pretty strong. One of the things, the hallmark of my service has always been civic engagement and community involvement. And you're right, I live in Area 4. And so not only was it important to me from a city perspective, it was important to me because I live in the neighborhood where these shootings were taking place. And this is, it sort of brings the conversation around. One of the reasons why this green collar policy is so important is it's an attempt to sort of employ some of the young people who are feeling so marginalized and disenfranchised that they go out and commit crimes and acts of violence on one another in our neighborhoods, which is something that we certainly can't tolerate, but we don't want to throw them away. We want to say, what can we do to hold on to you, to turn your life around so you can be a productive part of this, the citizenry? So the one thing that it was important to me was that we had to look at this issue, but we couldn't look at it from a top-down perspective. We had to engage the people that lived in this neighborhood, just come sit to the table and say, what can we do to change this? And so I called for this committee. It met over a year. The committee got formed. It had neighborhood representation. It met for a year. We developed policies around what we were going to do, excuse me, a proposal about what we were going to do to stop this wave of violent crime. What was important about the process was it brought everyone to the table, from the resident to the police chief, all got involved in making and bringing about change to our problem with crime in our community. You have to have the stakeholders at the table. It's just an important aspect of governing, in my opinion. The other thing, another strategy that I've always employed is the town meeting model. One of the things that I did a couple of years ago was to pull together a GLBT town meeting, the first our city has ever had. But out of that, we brought the GLBT community together with government officials just to talk about what were the important issues in the GLBT community. And from there, we now have a GLBT commission. So you have to engage your population, and we do that here. We do it through, I have done this a lot. I believe it is an effective way to encourage, engage, and communicate with the citizenry and build a strong community.
Well, Denise, I have to tell you, my jaw dropped when you said a GLBT town meeting. That's actually unheard of down south. I'm just floored to hear that. So the LGBT community then has input to things like aid services and what employment. Are those some of the things you talked about?
We talked about how we can keep our children safe in our schools. We talked about distribution of services. The commission, actually out of this GLBT town meeting, we talked about police community relations, and out of that, the GLBT commission, once formed, went into the police department and started doing training around diversity training and sensitivity training about how to work with, not deal with, but work with the GLBT community so everyone could feel affirmed. So regardless of who you were, you could walk into the police station and be treated fairly and with dignity. A major accomplishment, but easy to do because the Cambridge Police Department was open-minded and ready and willing to have that training. But it was speared on by the GLBT Commission, which came out of the town meeting process.
Well, this just sounds like I need to pack up and go. If I didn't think that I would freeze to death the minute I got there, probably.
You must come to Massachusetts. You know, my favorite thing to say about our Massachusetts, Cambridge in particular, is we have two seasons, winter and July. Come in July.
That sounds like a good plan. One other thing I was wondering about, Denise, if you would tell us about adult education. So many times there are people who, due to whatever life circumstances, didn't complete school or can't get a good job, do you have a vibrant adult education there and training?
Yes, we do. Actually, we have a program that's part of our Department of Human Services, which provides adult literacy, and we've worked on an ongoing basis to connect adult literacy with family literacy. We have two projects. One's the Agenda for Children. The Agenda for Children basically works with children around literacy, connecting families with books and opportunities to encourage their children how to read. We also have a very strong adult learning center called the Cambridge Adult Learning Center. And I hope I said that right. It's our program. I'm not always good with the name. But it's put in place for adults to either get their GED or their adult basic ed diploma. And it's a vibrant program. We have graduations of 30-plus individuals every year. And it's just wonderful to watch. And this program has been running for at least two decades, graduating and sending young adults and older citizens on to two-year colleges and four-year colleges and career training programs. And it's exciting to sit there in September at their graduations and talk about where they come from, one young lady last year said she stopped, you know, she had decided to have a family when she was young. She was raising her children. She never thought about going back to school. And here she was graduating with her diploma and telling us how she was now going on to college.
These are just amazing, amazing, amazing stories. Denise, when do you actually take office? Have you done that? Was it an immediate thing?
It was an immediate thing. Our inauguration, our election was November 6th of 2007, and the inauguration today is the first Tuesday in the new year. So we had the general inauguration of the council on Tuesday, January 7th. I was sworn in as the mayor on Monday, January 7th, if I didn't say that correctly. And I was sworn in as mayor the following Monday, January 14th.
Well, Denise, this is just wonderful stuff. Denise, I've asked you a series of questions, and I told you I'd only keep you for 30 minutes. So in closing, I just want to ask, are there things that I haven't asked about or that you would like to address and just tell us about? Because you seem like a person in a very good position to tell America how to do it, how it should be done. Give us some clues.
Well, you know, it's sort of staying the course. When I started this whole career, really started very simply. I started in my ward committee saying I just wanted to make a difference. I wanted to represent my neighbors. I wanted to work with my neighbors to make our little neighborhood a better place. And that went from, well, now I have kids in school, and I want the school to be a good place for my children to be. And by doing that work, I went on to the school committee because I really realized that you can't make a difference from talking about making a difference. You have to do the work. And by doing the work, that's what put me into the school committee and kept me into the school committee. I not only said I wanted to do the work for the people, I wanted to do the work with the people. I not only wanted to be their voice, I wanted to also be a part of their voice so that we talked in unison to make a difference for all families, African-American families, gay and lesbian families, for women, for people who have been on the margins of society, to get them into the center. So I have dedicated my life to just working for and with people to make our city a good place, the excellence in the place it is. It's not easy. It's hard work, but it's good work, and I enjoy doing it.
Well, Denise, it's been quite an honor to have you on the show. I would like to tell you that to please consider Strictly Confidential a friend and an ally. You don't have to have an invitation. You just pick up the phone. If there's not a guest on, such as yourself, I'll put you on the air immediately to say whatever you'd like to say. You are indeed welcome back here at any time, Denise and Denise Simmons. And what an honor to talk to you.
It's quite the pleasure, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, and good evening to you. Well, folks, that's the way it's done, where it's the way it's supposed to be done. People doing their jobs, and people who care, and people who are not stomped on and put down because they happen to be LGBT. What a wonderful place Cambridge must be. And indeed, she is replacing the previous mayor. There was no scandal or any reason why Ken Reeves left. She's just a standard transition. Ken Reeves is also an African-American, and he's a gay man, and he was the mayor just before Denise Simmons. Imagine that. I simply can't wrap my head around it living here at the dirt road. I got to tell you, I'm just beginning to think that all of this is an illusion out there. It's like the Twilight Zone where you're trapped and then you're trapped someplace and you just can't get out. I want to tell you this story. Then we're going to run a request track for the evening, but I've got to tell you this story. I stopped over at the Valerico Project today, and Bill Browning wrote a very short and what I consider to be inspired summary of the Democratic pageant, as we call it. They like to refer to it as a debate, but as we all know, there are no hard questions asked, so in fact it is a pageant. This is the description of the Democratic pageant per Bill Browning, and it's just inspired. First, Hillary said, "Obama likes slumlords," and Obama replied, "Yo mama, To which Edwards replied, "Ooh, she's dogging you, man." And then Obama interjected, "Hillary likes Walmart." Hillary responded, "I'm rubber, you're glue." Edwards explained, "I've never accepted a donation of Walmart glue." Obama then firmly stated, "I'm a black man." Hillary then adamantly replied, "I'm a woman." Edwards said, "So that everyone would know, I like women and blacks, and I'm pretty." Way to go, Bill. That is perhaps the best summary of the whole sordid event that I have ever come across in my entire life. Thank you. That was inspired. Request. We won't bother with a break, but we'll go ahead and run a music break. We have had a long-standing request for Funky Town. Now, Funky Town is by Lips, Inc., but you run it together. The way it's supposed to be pronounced, you run Lips, I-N-C, together so that it's Lips, Inc., which, of course, would be like moving your lips to music. Lips, Inc., but it's spelled L-I-P-P-S-I-N-C. Now, many people, because I sound like Fox News, don't I? Many people consider it to be the last disco song that went number one in the United States. But in any case, it's... Well, of course, we're not going to run just any version of Funky Town. Oh, no, 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 we don't do that sort of thing on Strictly Confidential. That goes against every grain in my little gay body. We are going to be running the Hot Tracks Revival remix of Funky Town, and personally, I think it's delightful, and I think you'll like it too. Bob, hit it. I have to laugh. What a wonderful track to follow up the interview with the mayor of Cambridge. Oh, boy, there's a lot of truth in that. Need to find a town that's right for me. I think Cambridge may very well be it. What a great track. That's a Hot Tracks remix. They don't make them like that anymore. That was a delightful track. Thank you for requesting that, Ella. One of our dear friends in chat, Mr. Lottie, sent an article in to me late this afternoon that's written by one of our previous guests. This particular previous guest is perhaps the most intellectually articulate man I have ever spoken to in my life. His name is John Shelby Spong. It's an incredible interview. If you'd like to go back and listen to that at some point, you can go to strictlyconfidentialradio.com and just click on the November calendar. You'll find John Shelby Spong listed as November the 26th. And what a conversation that was. John wrote an article called Governor Huckabee, a Second Generation Evangelical Politician. And he comes to some very interesting conclusions. In the first section, he develops the story about how President Lyndon Johnson managed to get the United States national voting rights through Congress. It was not an easy task at all. He had to maneuver the bill through a Senate that was controlled by the old line Southern Democrats and the Republicans that didn't want to move. He had to work with Everett Dirksen of Illinois. I don't know if you remember that name. In any case, it took a long time and a lot of skill, but Lyndon Johnson got it through. The final vote in the Senate was 47-17 among the Democrats, and it was 30-2 among the Republicans. It was a huge achievement. It was a massive achievement, and it signaled a new day in America that brought into full voting citizenship the vast number of disenfranchised black people in the South. Now, Bill Moyers was at that time serving as Johnson's chief of staff. He entered the Oval Office, and he was going to congratulate the president, President Lyndon Johnson, on the victory, and he fully expected to find President Johnson in a celebratory frame of mind with a smile on his face. But Mr. Moyers relates in his memoirs that he found the president in a mood of abject depression, is the way he puts it. He quotes the president as having said to him, "Bill, I have just handed the South to the Republican Party for the next 50 years. John Shelby Spong points out that he was remarkably correct. He goes on to develop this, and as I say, Spong is an amazing thinker. He's telling us here that racism was, of course, socially acceptable in the South. It was okay to say out loud how you felt about people of color. You only have to read the speeches of the Southern politicians prior to the Civil War, or even just prior to the Civil Rights Revolution. All you had to do is just read the speeches of the politicians. I assure you that the conversation in the street was much more virulent. Racism, though, lost its aura of respectability. It does not disappear, Spong points out. It simply becomes covert. And the code words that it developed and the code words that it ran under are two words, states' rights. Spong is pointing out, we believe the state has the right to discriminate without the interference of the federal government. How true that is. That's what state rights means. The states can discriminate in any way you wish. The federal government will not stand up about it. Spong points out that strict constructionist judges really mean judges who confuse constitutional democracy, meaning we the people, with a monocracy. And this monocracy will not extend constitutional rights to unpopular minorities. Now, Johnson understood that the newly enfranchised black voters are going to immediately identify themselves with the Democratic Party. After all, it was the Democratic Party that closed the deal to get this done. So that's not much of a stretch to assume that. So that also meant that the old white Southern establishment would inevitably, to preserve its covert racism, become Republican. Now, this is demonstrated in a number of people who were in office at the time. Many names are listed here, many of which you may not recognize coming from the era, but you will recognize Strom Thurmond. He was one of the ones who was able to, while in office, switch from being a Democrat to a Republican with no consequences whatsoever. There's a long list of them, senators and House representatives from Virginia, Texas, Alabama, a long list. He points out that the Democratic South had rested on three political foundations that protected white supremacy. One was keeping a strong military. Now, by the way, this was very well rewarded, Spong points out, by the location of numerous military bases in the South. It also was one of the other legs of this was supporting liberal economic benefits that would help the poor and middle-class white folks in southern states. And the positions also reflected the values that of the Southerners at the time. You know, the defense, the military, and the white supremacy was the third leg. By the way, this was at the time that they kept these three legs going by restricting black voters, and it kept political hands in the hands of the political power in the hands of the white establishment. And of course, second, during a period of slavery, it was based on subjugation of black people, and the Southerners cultivated a military virtue frame of mind. And you see, they identified that with chivalry and good manners, and you only have to look at the military schools. There's a Citadel in South Carolina. There's VMI in Virginia. This paid off. And but the third part of this is that poverty of white people in the South made populism a political necessity. But when segregation fell, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, when that fell, more than anything else, it brought down the Southern line. White Democratic voters found themselves completely willing to abandon populism, and the price of that abandoning populism was to join the Republican Party. He points out that racism in the South always trumps bread and butter issues, and that former Democrats began to portray themselves as values voters, which we've heard to the point that we are a little bit nauseous. These value voters would vote for the National Republican leadership, and they would throw them these emotional bones, as Spong puts it, of these bones being abortion, and make that a big political issue, and the breakdown in sexual morality, and campaigning against homosexuals, and who were threatening the marriage of the family. See, these are things the South could rally around, and the conservative establishment therefore married the populist Southern white voters, and the Southern white voters, as a trade-off, lost the populist version of their thought processes or the ideology. The right wing was wealth-oriented economic policies, and what happened. The new South, it became so powerful that only two Democrats could break control of the White House from 1968 to 2008. And Spong points out that was a born-again governor from Georgia and a Bible-toting Arkansas governor whose path to the White House was made easy by an economic downturn, and that the last Republican president in this era is George W. Bush, and he rode into power in 2000 by cultivating evangelical voters while he very quietly and, it wasn't quietly at all. It was, in fact, very overtly throughout his born-again story. And they bought it hook, line, and sinker. The tax cuts did not benefit the poor or the middle class, which is, we would expect that. The populist folks in the South didn't. They still trusted him. The restrictions that he put on prosecuting big business gave us Enron and WorldCom and Tyco and the housing subprime market of today. The military adventures in Iraq made the cost of gasoline and health care and education skyrocket. And it also revealed a bizarre series of sexual escapades. There's Jimmy Swaggart and, the It's really not even necessary to go into the list of them here. We've been through it. We all know it very well. We know it verse, line, and chapter. So this is basically what happened. The Republican Party was the conservatives, those the ones who were in power, and Johnson predicted quite correctly that they would remain in their hands for 50 years. So he says, Spong is saying that the South was waiting for a candidate that could see that right to life doesn't stop at birth, and that it's important even for the children of evangelicals to be educated. And he points out that it's important for evangelicals to know their kids can find jobs that haven't been exported to Mexico or India or China, and that gay marriage doesn't seem nearly as scary. You know, they finally caught on to the fact that Foley with the House Pages, the Republican senator in Idaho, and wide stance guy, and then there's the Haggard, which was carrying on with the male prostitute, et cetera, et cetera. They have suddenly realized, Spong is pointing out, that they have been taken for a ride. Now, this is very slow, and you want to kick them for taking all of these years to catch on to it. But nonetheless, Spong is saying that this is what is going on in the South. And Spong is saying that he doesn't think that Huckabee is going to be able to carry the South. Huckabee, even though he is second generation, he's combined family values with the Southern bread and butter politics. And he's also combined it with that the populist frame of mind of helping the poor. But he's combined it with that ultra-right-wing anti-gay, anti-abortion stance. And so Spong is asking, can the Republican Party do without a Southern evangelical vote to win? And he says, I don't think so. In summary, Spong is pointing out that he believes that it's been 43 years since the Voting Rights Act became law, and he thinks that 50-year gift of the South to the Republican Party is nearing its end. This is encouraging, and from someone who is as deep a thinker to John Spong, I have to pause and think about it. We often hear, don't believe that this is ever going to end, but Spong seems to feel that this whole thing is going to turn around, that the South may be moving back toward its overt racism and moving back toward some sort of a position that that will allow the country to survive and take it out of the hands of the capitalists. It's gotten pretty bad, as we all know. And by the way, the different topic here. I should tell you, the toll-free number, if you'd like to call in and join, it's 877, the number 4 head-on, or you can use area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. The American Family Association, and I thought I was good. They're proudly pointing out that Governor Huckabee has a brand new movie star who is joining his camp. And this Hollywood actor is Stephen Baldwin. Oh, the American Family Association says that Stephen Baldwin is an outspoken evangelical, and he has endorsed former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee for president. They also point out that Steve Spaulding became a born-again Christian shortly after the 2001 terrorist attack. Well, isn't that just hand in glove? Oh, my. It doesn't associate it with any sort of personal conviction or change of heart. It was the mad as hell, not going to take it anymore, 2001 terrorist attack. Baldwin is pointing out that a big part of what's wrong with the country is morals and values and things like that. Things like that. Well, that's deep. Says, I think faith-based initiatives are going to help us get back on course. Well, glory be, do you think? I kind of think we might have tried that. He says that nobody's recognizing that Huckabee came out of nowhere. And he's saying that Huckabee was most unpopular of all the people. Now, look how well he's doing. He's really smart, and he's qualified, and it's not nearly over. And that Florida and the other primaries that are coming up will bring him back of the back to the top. He says, Huckabee is a wonderful man, and he feels like Huckabee is a guy that, in my opinion, I can trust because he has faith-based realities. I'm sorry, but I... And by the way, the beginning of this article points out very stridently that Stephen Baldwin is joining a long list of actors and celebrities. In fact, it reads literally that a long list of celebrities that publicly endorse the presidential candidate, Huckabee. Can anyone think of anybody other than Chuck Norris and now Stephen Baldwin? Who is that the long list? One, two, gee, the paper goes white after this. I'm not able to count any higher. So there you have it. Steve Baldwin, that's another guy. We won't be renting his movies anymore, will we? There seems to be, nobody can figure this out. It's posted on many of the gay blogs, the gay news blogs, and everyone is commenting on it, but nobody can figure out why he did it. And that is that Al Gore made a statement on his current television program. And nobody knows why. I mean, he's not running for president, and he's been silent on LGBT issues for all these years. But with no explanation, all of a sudden he comes out on his cable station called Current TV with a statement. And we have that statement. And, Bob, if we could, let's just follow that statement with the top of the hour break. This is Al Gore for no particular reason. Run it, Bob.
I think it's wrong for the government to discriminate against people because of that person's sexual orientation. I think that gay men and women ought to have the same rights as heterosexual men and women to make contracts, to have hospital visiting rights, to join together in marriage, and I don't understand why it is considered by some people to be a threat to heterosexual marriage to allow it by gays and lesbians. Shouldn't we be promoting the kind of faithfulness and loyalty to one's partner, regardless of sexual orientation? Because if you don't do that, then to that extent, you're promoting promiscuity, and you're promoting all the problems that can result from promiscuity. And the loyalty and love that two people feel for one another when they fall in love ought to be celebrated and encouraged and shouldn't be prevented by any form of discrimination in the law.
You want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
As I understand the conflict right now between the president's bill and the one supported by the Democrats, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, is that John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the Democrats say that the bill, the standards we use, should be the standards that are the same as the treaty we signed, the Geneva Convention signed after World War II that every civilized nation follows. And the president is saying, that restricts me too much. That's too humane. I want to be able to do other things. I won't say what they are, but sources tell us that things like waterboarding, you know, drowning people, putting them in 50-degree weather. And the question, I think, is should we hold the United States to the same standards that England holds itself to, that Canada holds itself to, that other civilized nations hold themselves to?
Get the view from inside the Beltway with Mark Levine on the Radio Inside Scoop. Right here, 2 to 3 p.m. weekdays on the Head On Radio Network.
Has anyone ever said you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
And he's back, riding across the country on a horse named Strictly Confidential. It's moi, Peter Godbold, and the telephone number toll-free is 877, the number 4, head-on. You can reach the show Strictly Confidential and join in the conversation. The area code is 304-658-3333 if you have unlimited long distance. I should also tell you that the show is brought to you in part by the Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net, the Coal River Mountain Watch, and we thank you for your support. I think by now everyone knows that Heath Ledger was found dead in New York City. As I've told you before, I had to give up television simply because I would scream very loudly and throw things, and it disturbed Doggy, so we gave it up. Nonetheless, I think I can, without asking a soul, tell you that this is being covered widely on the Alphabet networks. I would be shocked to find out that I am wrong about that. It has everything that the ABC networks and the CBS networks and the Fox networks just love. Apparently he was found without clothes, and he is the star of Brokeback Mountain along with several other major films. Apparently a housekeeper found him dead. There were various bottles of sleeping pills, I believe, opened. Now they're claiming to have found a rolled-up $20 bill and blah, 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 blah. And it's a tragedy. And my first reaction to seeing this was, you know, he struck down so early. He's only 28 years old. And actually, at the very beginning of his career, this man would have gone on to become one of the names, stage, screen, and television. I can guarantee you he was off to a wonderful start. And it's a shame that happened to him. Having some personal knowledge regarding addiction and drugs, I can tell you that it is a terrible waste. So you can go to the mainstream media or any of the blogs to find out more about his death if you don't know about it. But what I am going to cover is the announcement from Westboro Baptist Church, and it is predictably disgusting. It is a news release that was released Tuesday, January 22nd. They wasted no time in getting this out. By the way, if you'd like to stop by and support them, it's www.godhatesfags.com. News release, Brokeback Mountain star Heath Ledger is dead. The Westboro Baptist Church will picket his funeral. Now here I have to pause. Heath Ledger is from Perth, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, that's correct. And I assume his family is still there. Does anyone know if he's going to actually be interned here in the United States? And if he is interned in Australia, will anybody buy the Westboro Baptist Church a steerage ticket on the Titanic, preferably, to get them there? And I wonder how the laws in Australia read regarding vermin like this ticketing at funerals. Just under the announcement in bold that the Westboro Baptist Church will picket his funeral, it reads, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind. As with womankind, it is an abomination. For because of these things cometh the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience." It then says, yes, that's a complete sentence, yes, period. Westboro Baptist Church, meaning Phelps, Fred Phelps, and his gaggle of, I can only say, a scene from Deliverance on the front porch will give you an idea of these knuckle draggers. The Westboro Baptist Church will picket this pervert's funeral in religious protest and warning. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Heath Ledger, it goes on to read, thought it was great fun defying God Almighty and his plan and his word, to wit, God hates fags and God hates fag enablers. Ergo, God hates the sordid, tacky bucket of slime seasoned with vomit known as Brokeback Mountain, and he hates all persons having anything whatsoever to do with it. It also, because they apparently have a main line to God, we are now informed in huge bold print, Heath Ledger is now in hell. I assume they're on the reservation desk. Heath Ledger is now in hell and has begun serving his eternal sentence there. Besides which, nothing else about Heath Ledger is relevant or consequential. Yep. That's right there. That's the mimeograph sheet. Boy, yes, they are going to, you know, wouldn't surprise me if they're not gathering around the coroner's office now. I believe they're going to be going through some examinations to see exactly what the cause of death was. Terrible shame about Heath Ledger. A very good-looking man, but in all of his movies, he sort of played that down. You know, he wasn't riding on his looks alone. Wonderful actor, and he will be missed by many people who will never, ever know. By the way, the Center for Disease Control, if you'll recall, there was a huge stir regarding the MRSA, which is a drug-resistant staph infection that is being found amongst gay men in major cities. It's also being found, by the way, in hospitals and schools, and being found in a lot of places. But the mainstream media, the way this article was phrased, jumped all over it that it was emanating and coming from the LGBT community. The Center for Disease Control has stepped in and said that they deplore this, that they had never intended that the mainstream media take this and run with it as some sort of a sexual. In fact, it's not even confirmed at this point that it is sexually transmitted. Just touching and or holding or skin contact is the way it's spread apparently. And so the fundies are jumping all over it. It's another wave, another punishment from God. That, and you know, but you know, now that the CDC has said that they implore the mainstream media in saying this and bringing this out and apologizing for the way it was phrased, that they never intended this for it to happen. Now that they have said that, of course, the damage is already done. Much like the people who still think Obama is a terrorist who trained in the suicide bombing camps, who because they read an email years ago, and which is probably being circulated as we speak. I haven't seen a copy of it in a while, but no doubt it's being reissued in a higher powered form. But, you know, once something like this happens, the mainstream media drops it like a hot potato. So you can be sure that there are many, many people who are firmly convinced that this is another act of God. But, you know, that's what it's like living in America, is it not? It's even worse living in other places. Did you know that the European Union has now decided that it's Bulgaria. Bulgaria is the most anti-gay country on the continent. There's a poll that was recently released shows that 80% of Bulgarians expressed a negative view of gays and lesbians, with 53% extremely negative. Only 17% of Bulgarians say they would be able to carry on a conversation with someone who is gay. That's appalling to me. This just isn't the way the world is supposed to be. It is simply not the way it's supposed to be. Yet it continues, generation after generation. The survey also found that half of them, Bulgarians, would refuse to work. That's 50% would refuse to work with someone they thought was gay. 70% of Bulgarians say they would take their children out of school if they found out that one of the teachers was gay. 50% said they would disown a child who turned out to be gay. And that figure was much higher than 50%, although it's not listed. It was much higher than 50% if the child were transgendered. Bulgaria did not decriminalize homosexuality until 2002. They had to do that to conform to the European Union norms. Nonetheless, there is great controversy going on there now. You remember the two twins, the identical twin brothers. One was a prime minister. The other one was a president. Both of them conservative nutcases. This was the sort of part of their rule. It was part of their ultra-conservative stance. The Amnesty report went on to say that Poland members of sexual minorities continue to face discrimination and restrictions on their right of freedom to even express themselves or assemble. Openly homophobic statements are prominent in radio and television by politicians and public officials. There are reports of continued attacks against demonstrators that the police will not interfere with. So that's what it's like in Bulgaria. There are many other details. One interesting one is that a doctor, it was an extremely serious case in my estimation, there was a doctor who refused treatment to a patient with advanced AIDS because he had no medical insurance, although Hungarian law provides for free medical care to anyone with a condition that is a threat to life, unlike the United States. But the doctor didn't feel that this patient was worthy of that coverage under the Hungarian law. In fact, the nation only has one AIDS treatment facility, so patients really have nowhere to hide. Typical that gay couples are asked to leave if they're in a concert or thrown out. You know, you have to wonder how long this stuff is going to go on, don't you? By the way, something that's interesting. You know, they're so worried about, this just tickles the hell out of me. They're so worried about, you know, not letting don't ask, don't tell pass away. That even though it's really being sloppily enforced, if it's being enforced at all, because of you know, it's military. Basically, it's employment in the U.S. government is what it boils down to. But we are about to see a tidal wave of empty desks at the U.S. government, and this is largely due to the fact that the baby boomers are retiring. According to this, the federal government's going to lose one-third of its full-time workforce over the next 5 years. That is one-third. That's a lot of people. That is 530,000 workers. Now, in just the next 2 years alone, the government will have to fill 23,000 nursing spots, 3,000 air traffic controllers, 63,000 security, our law enforcement officials. The list goes on and on. Of course, with the current meltdown, it's hard to know what's going to be happening in a few years. But nonetheless, if all continues with the phony money and the blah 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 of the politician, if all continues and the stores stay open and we don't end up stealing each other's potatoes that we're growing in the backyard, the government will have to fill 530,000 jobs. So clearly. The government cannot afford to alienate anyone, including LGBT folks. So you see, this is in addition to the fact that the federal government pays about 23% less than the private sector for comparable jobs, unless, of course, you happen to be a high-end politician. But any actual working person in the government earns about 23% less. Of course, you could say that there are benefits, the number of holidays, the insurance, job security, blah, 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 blah. Might outweigh that. It is still 23% less, and 23% less is a huge chunk of change. But any way you look at it, the government can no longer continue to lock out talented people. And so there is a bipartisan congressional legislation right now that's going to offer partners of gay federal workers the same benefits, including health insurance, provided to spouses of married heterosexuals. I haven't seen a report on this yet by the American Family Association, even though this happened about a week or so ago. It seems to me plenty of time for them to have reacted and screamed loudly, but apparently they have not yet. They will if this goes any further. I couldn't believe it. The Senate sponsor of this is, Lordy, Joe Lieberman. You gotta wonder sometimes. You really have to wonder how this stuff all comes together. None of it makes sense. It is so difficult to wrap your head around this from day to day. Lieberman is saying that, pointing out, Lieberman says, and I quote, "Government will always be at a disadvantage in competing for and retaining highly qualified personnel if it cannot match the domestic partner benefit programs provided by leading non-federal employers." Then Lieberman added that most Fortune 500 companies, including General Electric, IBM, AT&T, and, of course, that evil company, Microsoft. One of our chatters is pointing out that maybe the AFA has foamed at this, but I've missed it. In any case, I'll look again harder. But in any case, I got to tell you that... Lieberman also pointed out that in Romania, remember the ambassador to Romania, he quit the State Department because he made a public announcement and he criticized Condi, the shoe queen, over the fact that his partner didn't have any benefits. In other words, whenever he moved, he would have to pay for the moving expenses for his partner. If they had to fly back and forth to the United States, he would have to pay to fly his partner. If there's a life-threatening illness and it can only be treated in the United States, if you were an ambassador, you'd get flown back to the United States for free, but not for his partner. And the list goes on and on and on. So he quit his job as the former ambassador. He was the ambassador to Romania, and he quit that job. And, of course, Lieberman pointed that out. The man said, I have felt compelled to choose between my obligations to my partner, who is family, and service to my country. He says, no one should have to make a decision like that, and it's a shame for the department and our country. This is what the former ambassador said. That was a man named Michael Guest, by the way. It was his farewell ceremony. So, you know, the government's stuck between a rock and a hard place. A lot of LGBT folks, when they are educated, tend to be highly educated, so probably make a good workforce. And you have to wonder, maybe a workforce under a different administration, except for the log cabin Republicans. I can't imagine anybody who'd want to tarnish themselves or get the dirt and the grime of having this administration and working with it in any way whatsoever. And speaking, by the way, of the log cabin Republicans, here we go. You know, shame thy name is log cabin Republican. Guilt thy name is log cabin Republican. As we all know, nobody in the GOP race has done a damn thing to actively court any gay voters. And it's hard to believe, but yes, there are still some gay Republicans out there. It's the log closet Republicans. And they have still yet to endorse anyone. This is the same game that they played back in George W. Bush's 2004 election. They just voluntarily sidelined themselves. I don't know how they sleep at night, but somehow they do, probably with some sleep aids. But even though they're not making endorsements, they are active on the sideline. You see, they are very, 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 very bad at Romney. They do not like him, not one little bit, because of the fact that, Romney has changed his mind. And let me give you an example of here of what they do. In Iowa, the log cabin Republicans aired a television ad on the Fox News Network. And what the ad was banking on was that the Christian conservatives in Iowa were a voting bloc that that they needed to discourage from voting for Romney. So in this television ad, they referred to Romney, they described him as a man with Massachusetts values. You know, these are LGBT people. In fact, well, I'll take that back. I have never seen a female log cabin Republican. So women take pride in that. Every single one of the lizards I've ever seen are male. But anyway, these guys, the Massachusetts values, which we just heard so succinctly from our guest earlier in the evening, the mayor of Cambridge, Ms. Denise Simmons, by the way. I think I've learned that at this point. So they're decrying him for being having Massachusetts values, and the ad also said, for years he's fought conservatives and religious extremists, and he's even opposed the gun lobby, and he's even opposed Ronald Reagan. Yes, this is an ad run by supposedly gay guys. And you see what they're doing here. It's so typically Republican. It's so typically side door. It's so typically deceptive and controlling and manipulative. It hypocrite thy name be log cabin Republican. Now, they also started a radio ad in New Hampshire. This is the log cabin Republicans, mind you, who will not endorse anyone, yet they trash the ones that they don't want. So in New Hampshire, they were saying that Romney, what they call Mitt Flops, that's MITT, Mitt Flops. And they said, despite the fact he promised not to raise his taxes, he would sock New Hampshire residents and who are commuting to jobs in Massachusetts with a payroll levy hike. And see, they got ticked off at Romney when back in 94, I believe, when he was all for gay marriage, and then as he decided to run for president, then he began backing off of that as quickly as possible. Then he was not even for civil unions anymore, and he dropped At one time he would say he was for civil unions, not marriage, as part of his retraction. Then he's not for any of it. And then he went further rabid and said that, you know, began to support the amendment to the Constitution in Massachusetts. And then he trotted out the 1913 racist law in Massachusetts that it was written a long, long time ago so that interracial marriages that were banned in other states, Massachusetts wouldn't have to acknowledge those marriages because they were taking place out of state if they were interracial. And he also said that Massachusetts would become the Las Vegas of gay marriage. So the log cabin Republicans are all ticked off with Mr. Romney. And they're running negative ads. And, of course, they're also not too thrilled about Huckabee. Basically, the only two people that leaves left, what is it, the other two, Giuliani and McCain. And it's hard to know. Yet they won't endorse either one of them. There's various things they've done against Huckabee, too, but I know we're all tired of hearing about Huckabee. But, you know, what kind of a choice is that, McCain or Giuliani? And, of course, Giuliani was their darling at the very beginning. You know, that was the log closet Republicans were all goo-goo-eyed over Giuliani. And, of course, Giuliani has changed his tune, too. McCain also was one of the handful of Republicans to oppose the marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution, so that's a plus in McCain's column. But, oh, what limited little choices you have. I don't know how these people manage to live with themselves and move on from day to day. They're really not gay. They couldn't possibly be gay. They're probably straight people. That's what it is. They are straight people, and they pretend that they're gay, and they're doing this so that gay people look bad. That's what it's really got to be, right? I wish. Boy, there are some sick gay people out there, aren't there, honey? And they're not in the schoolyards. They are in the log closet. That's where they are. As I told you or intended to tell you earlier this evening, gay bar across the street segment this evening is Mr. Bobby Vittoretti, and I'm pleased to have him back again tonight. And if you recall, the last time Bobby played, we played from the 1977. We played from the Marlin Beach Hotel, a live audio from the recorded live at the Marlin Beach Hotel. We told you the story about the huge decks that overlooked the beaches and the tunnels that went from the dance floor out to the beach and the lights that lit up the bottom of the swimming pool with the glass windows. Just a fabulous place, absolutely fabulous place. And Bobby was indeed one of the legend DJs that played there. Actually, what we're going to do this evening, we're going to pick up with the mix that Bobby Vittoretti ran at the Marlin Beach Hotel. We're going to pick up with it exactly where we left off the other evening, because it's just wonderful stuff. So as we gather ourselves, gather up our little umbrellas, and we put on our little flip-flops, and we head back for the beach, into the tunnel, under the highway, and into the disco that is the Marlin Beach Hotel. This is Bobby Vittoretti. And as we return from the Marlin Beach Hotel, right there overlooking the ocean, with the sea breezes wafting in on a wonderful evening, the stars out, the moon, and Mr. Bobby Vittoretti at the turntables. What a wonderful time that must have been. And very kind of Bobby to share that with us. By the way, tomorrow we'll be featuring Mr. Jerry Bonham, and he will be our DJ tomorrow evening at the Gay Bar Across the Street segment. And Jerry is going to be bringing his music that was played at the Trocadero just this past year in 2007, and we'll pick up where we left Jerry Bonham when he last appeared in the show. Next week we'll have Larry Sanders back, and we'll have JVC, we'll have Victor back, and the list keeps growing, and I'm looking forward to that. The guest tomorrow evening will be Alexander Robinson. Now, Alexander Robinson is the CEO of the National Black Justice Coalition. You may recall we had Soul Force on the program not too long ago, and Soul Force talked about a partnership with the National Black Justice Coalition, along with an outfit called Collage, and they are going to be joining also with the Metropolitan Community Church. Their goal is to, over a period of time, visit the megachurches. They're going to be visiting Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, and Potter's House in Dallas. These are all mega churches. The Hope Christian Church in Maryland, a New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Georgia, the Willow Creek Community Church in Illinois, a Saddleback Church in the Lake Forest, California, to open a dialogue with the faith community regarding LGBT inclusion in their spiritual lives as opposed to what we are currently experiencing. We will have the folks with us tomorrow night who are partnering the NBJC to talk about what's happening there. Interestingly enough, the Focus on the Family is up in arms about this. They are terrified that there is going to be an actual conversation taking place. You realize, of course, that the Focus on the Family group does a huge amount of fundraising on our backs. And so they have sent out a communication to all of the churches warning the churches not to meet with Soul Force and the NBJC or Collage. Under no circumstances should they meet. They are saying, as with any temptation to disregard God's clear word on any given matter, this attempt by Soul Force and their allies is a classic example of what we see in Genesis chapter 3 when the serpent tempts Eve. I'm sorry. I have to tell you, though. When the serpent tempts Eve. So we are going to be appearing to these churches in the form of a serpent, apparently. And so we'll be talking with the NBJC tomorrow evening about their partnership with Soul Force and about what's going on in visiting these churches. This should be very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. The NBJC represents is an organization that advocates peace and justice and for black and people of color, LGBT folks in the world, and I'm looking forward to talking with them. Need to tell you that this evening we will have a All Foxed Up show at midnight. John Fox will be joining us from Australia at 12 midnight for his program Foxed Up, which is always a great program. We love John, and we love his laugh. We'll also be having a horn section. The horn section will take place just as this program closes. And that will be John and myself, and it will be Mr. Bob Kincaid. And so it's been a great, great evening with you guys. Also want to point out to you that Friday's guest is Justin Utley. He's a singer, songwriter, and musician, and an actor. And Justin will be a unique guest, and he is a fresh new voice from Utah, of all places. So that'll be an interesting show for Friday also. So thank you for being here. I've enjoyed myself. You were appreciated. And here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too. Oh.
Ask any musician. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to The Horn Section.